Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and our total environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our systems, the health of our society, the health of our communities, and the health and ecology of the planet Earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different experts, authors, scientists, advocates, thought leaders about all of the different aspects of our greater world and how they affect our well-being and the well-being of our families and the future generations. For the last 3 to 4 and counting months, we've been covering the secret trade deals on Connect the Dots, TPP, Fast Track, Global Trade Agreements, treaties, etc. We're covering them week after week with different experts and thought leaders. We're discussing different aspects of them. This show is actually being pre-recorded, and the date that it airs, in fact, we think and hope, and it will be a good sign if the treaties, which are have passed the Senate in previous weeks and are poised, as at this recording, to go to the House for a vote via fast-track authority that would be granted to President Obama to rubber-stamp the treaties. It will be optimistic and hope that the treaties have not yet passed the House when this show is aired to you. And if so, and I trust and hope that will be the case, there are still actions that you can take that we'll discuss, as well as discussing the ramifications and the tremendous turning point that the treaties represent, as we will on today's show. We're going to give those actions a little later on in the middle of our conversation. But right now, I want to take this opportunity to introduce our guest, and we'll begin the conversation. The show is titled The U.S. Defender of Democracy or Profiteer from Slave Trade. We'll be talking to Stan Sorcher, labor representative at the Society for Professional Engineering, Employees in Aerospace. And he's been a repeated guest on this program, and he also blogs on the Huffington Post and brings a sort of an inside knowledge of kind of how things work in Washington, as well as representing the labor movement, which is one of the largest primary opponents to these trade deals that we've been covering, because of the fact that it so adversely affects manufacturing, jobs, the economy, and the middle class, which, of course, he represents and is concerned about. We won't be going through a lot of the kind of background information. If this is the first show you're listening to, you may want to either consult my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, or my Facebook page, Allison Rose Levy, as well, or you may want to look into the archives of the Connect the Dots radio show, and you can Google that by archives plus PRN plus Connect the Dots, and you'll find prior interviews with Stan and other guests that really kind of set the groundwork. So we're going to plunge in today. If you need that background, please do go back and listen to prior shows. So welcome once again to Connect the Dots, Stan Sorcher. Lovely to have you with us again today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Today, you know, basically the thing that, you know, you've written about and, you know, many people are wondering about is kind of how bad this can get. There seems to be a tremendous confidence, despite, you know, ample opposition in the House, which we are hoping will hold and say no and, you know, stop the passage of the fast-track trade authority that would allow the president to sign these treaties sight unseen, except for, fortunately, leaks that have come in, and we've even had recent leaks coming in, which we'll discuss a little bit today. There's been this, you know, many, many people calling and writing in a lot of opposition, but there still seems to be a sort of a sense of entitlement or confidence exemplified by the president and his Republican partners and some of the Wall Street, so-called Wall Street Democrats that are aligning with him, these trade deals are perfect, that they represent a wonderful economic opportunity, an opportunity for democracy, that they're better than past trade agreements. And yet, you know, recently it has come to light that, you know, there are countries that will be participating in which the president insists are, you know, vital and necessary for inclusion, thinking of Malaysia here, who really fall down in the human rights and labor rights area to a degree that, you know, if we are saying that we're bringing others up to our level rather than, you know, descending to the worst of the worst of what goes on, sadly, here on planet Earth, by, you know, insisting on their inclusion without any ability to intervene on behalf of their, you know, their citizens that are, you know, really in a very troubling situation, we're not really exemplifying the stance for democracy that we espouse. Can you let our listeners know a little bit about what is going on with Malaysia and what the concerns are?
Sure. So I think, you know, for context, it mm-hmm. helps to think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations have been going on for 5 years, and it's a very intense diplomatic experience for the people involved. But their focus has been pretty much entirely on the interests of global businesses and investors and corporate rights. And they really haven't given much attention at all to things that affect people in their daily lives, you know, human rights, labor rights, the environment, public health. Those issues haven't really been important to the negotiators, so they've kind of psychologically gotten out of touch. If you think about where concerns publicly have been expressed, the House of Representatives, 150 members of the House, wrote a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative, our chief negotiator, expressing concerns about Vietnam and saying, look, here's Vietnam is a communist country with a command economy and no labor rights at all. How would they fit into the negotiations? And Mexico has had labor rights problems, you know, since NAFTA, and how do they fit into the TPP? Suddenly, a week or two ago, news accounts put the spotlight on Malaysia. Malaysia has some serious problems with human rights and human trafficking and forced labor and child labor going back for at least a decade. But there are some refugees who are particularly in Malaysia who are particularly vulnerable to human trafficking. And these terrible camps were found where the refugees were kept, including a mass grave site with 139 graves of men, women, and children who showed signs of torture. So this is pretty dramatic. This is astonishing. This is jaw-dropping. And suddenly, you know, Malaysia is one of the 12 TPP countries. So for years, we've been thinking of Malaysia as an economic partner that has an electronics industry and has agricultural products and that we've been trading with and has some kind of geopolitical status in that part of the country, in that part of the world. Suddenly, here's this other image of Malaysia as a consistent human rights violator. So the State Department has a ranking of all the countries in the world according to where they stand in terms of human trafficking. This is part of legislation that was passed in Congress a long time ago that the State Department evaluates every country's human rights record. Malaysia had been consistently very poorly ranked, ranked very low on this. So this is not a surprise. And they were actually, so the categories are tier one with the United States and most Western countries. Tier two are countries that have human trafficking problems but are taking some kinds of steps. And tier three are countries that have very poor human rights records and are not taking steps. And there's Malaysia ranked in this third tier. And again, it's just shocking to see these two different images. Malaysia as a developing country partner in global commerce versus Malaysia ranked tier three for consistently having a very poor human rights record. So there are two things that happened to Malaysia. One was this announcement of the discovery of the mass graves. The second thing was in Congress, the Senate had passed its version of fast track, the procedural trade legislation, and an amendment was put in, kind of a surprise, that said fast track would not apply if any of the countries in the trade agreement were on the tier three list of State Department human trafficking. And, you know, as a senator, you'd look at that and say, sure, I mean, why would we have tier three violators in a trade agreement? And the amendment passed without much thought. And suddenly somebody looked up and said, well, wait, Malaysia is actually on the tier three list. Malaysia is in TPP. So taking what seemed to be a simple action in the Senate of standing up for human rights suddenly turns into a major roadblock for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So with that motivation, people are now looking at what's going on in Malaysia. And, of course, the more they look, the worse they get.
And, you know, I know this is going to be, you know, sort of a little detailed and everything, but, you know, I think many people, myself among them, I mean, don't think about, like, human trafficking, what it might consist of. I mean, this is so far removed from, you know, the world that, you know, first world people listening to this program might know, that it's, you know, it's almost hard to imagine, actually. You know, can you just describe a little bit what we're talking about here? When we say human rights,
right? So exactly. This, again, this is a sort of a revelation. As I think for everybody, I live in Seattle, and we have a campaign here about human trafficking, and there are signs, you know, posters on the buses, and and every country has a, you know, either more or less awareness of human trafficking, but you know, in the region here, this is actually a big deal for us. So. For us, we see human trafficking, and I think the other categories are forced labor and child labor, and then exploitation, you know, sexual exploitation, but also a lot of this is in terms of labor. So if you look at the signs on our buses, they say, I was promised a job, but they took my passport and I can't leave. That's common. I think we've seen examples of that around the world. Sometimes there are situations which we call wage theft, where the employer simply doesn't pay the worker, and or you are bound by debt that you had to pay a fee, and you can't get your passport or leave until you pay off your fee. And so those are categories of forced labor. And in the case of the State Department country reports, they write a long, you know, narrative report on each country. In Malaysia, 28% of the workers in the electronics industry are categorized as forced labor, which means that they're bound by a fee or denied their wages or captive in some way that they can't leave their job. You know, in our history, there was the company store, right, that you...
Right.
You know, what did Kenneth Henry Ford say? I owe my soul to the company store.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
You would be paid in company scrip, and you could only use the scrip at the company store, and pretty soon you're in debt to the company store, and you can't leave, right? You can't leave until you pay off your debt. You're bound. And so these are, and they do things like that. It, you know, there's a certain amount of creativity involved, but it really is a systemic labor practice that makes employees at risk and vulnerable and precarious and certainly not able to, you know, function in terms of demanding a share of their gain. So if you're asking how is wealth going to be distributed or who has power or what the power relationships are, all of these things are really shocking. Ways of taking advantage of the employees. The child labor, again, you know, in our history, we've had child labor until fairly, you know, recently. I'm disturbing to think about it. we take for granted now that child labor is not a modern practice. It's a, barbaric. Malaysia's palm oil industry, systematic use of children and child labor. And again, you know, either Malaysia is going to live up to global standards or Malaysia is going to ignore global standards. If you read the State Department report, you know, the picture clearly is that Malaysia knows that these are practices that are not acceptable, you know, and as international norms. They've had the opportunity, they've passed laws that acknowledge that, but then they don't enforce the laws. And if 28% of the workers in the electronics industry, this would be the flagship industry in Malaysia, are subject to these forced labor conditions, this really sends a message to every other business in the electronics industry, every other industry in Malaysia, that if you're going to be competing in the global economy or in Malaysia, you know, these are, you know, the anchor industries of Malaysia, the electronics, garments, and palm oil industry, that's the standard that everybody else is going to have to live down to. So it really is kind of a mechanism for the race to the bottom.
So, you know, one of the things you and other guests on the show have mentioned this phrase, a race to the bottom, and I think it's probably not intuitively obvious to other people, you know, what a race to the bottom actually means. My understanding, and please, you know, fill this out or correct me, you know, if I'm wrong, is that if you have a labor force providing consumer products, you know, you mentioned the computer industry. These are products that, you know, we use. Presumably anyone who has a smartphone or computer or whatever is actually, you know, using these products. And if they're made abroad, you know, at a low price and, you know, the people aren't well compensated, you know, then we pay for them here and someone's kind of pocketing the difference, you know, for having, you know, brought them over. Which, you know, is kind of something that's accepted and everything. But they could, you know, potentially they could pocket less, you know, of that difference by paying the people better. But they're not electing to do so. And then the other part of it is that if the people who are making these parts of products or products have such a low living wage and are, you know, under, as you're describing, you know, enslaved, near enslaved conditions that they cannot readily escape from, obviously, if American workers were to do the job, if those industries were to be here, you know, there would be a higher fee paid to workers, so to the workers doing them, so and other protections like health insurance or whatever. So the fact that they're being done by people who are doing them for so little remuneration actually is both affecting the, you know, unfortunate people who are trapped in that situation, as well as it's harming us because if they were, and other countries, because if they were produced under more humane conditions, it could be, you know, it could be done elsewhere. So one of the reasons it's, you know, it's not being done in a country where it's supporting a living wage that is, you know, of dignity and appropriate for someone to, in, you know, kind of have a decent, you know, modest but decent life. If that isn't happening, it's because these practices are allowed and they bring down, you know, what the places that would provide better for their people. And sort of destitute them while relying upon, you know, people who are leading a life that is very degraded, so that the companies can, you know, make a bigger return on their investment. So, you know, if that practice happens in one place and another place and another place, and in effect to earn any kind of living anywhere in the world, we are competing with people who are suffering under the lowest common denominator of governmental rights or protections and income. And so is that what then progressively over time means that we all kind of sink to the bottom, to that level? Is that what the, is that how that relates to, you know, the phrase race to the bottom, or is it some other way?
Sure. Well, yeah, so, you know, actually I'm a physicist and I always think in terms of some kind of mechanism, right, that there's some cause and effect process here. So let me give you an example. People always say trade is disruptive, trade creates winners and losers, and the winners could compensate the losers. And, you know, when you were describing that situation, you said the people who are winners could choose to share those gains with their workers. In America, certainly, the point of being a winner is to win. But in our culture, we don't win to share with the losers. We win to win. There was a time when we felt an obligation to share and have shared prosperity, but you know, for the last 20 years or so, that hasn't been a strong cultural value for us. So what does happen? In my experience, right, I'm in a labor union. The old language was the union makes a demand and the employer, you know, negotiates. And we negotiate over the union demand. So as an individual, you don't usually go into your, you know, employer and demand something, but that's a different language, a different psychology, a different expectation. You can only demand something when you have power, and you only have power, you know, when you think you have power. You have to believe that you deserve, you have earned a share of the gains you create, and then you're going to make a demand. So there's a certain, and then you negotiate, and there's some kind of power relationship, right? So let's suppose you're making your demands, and the employer says, you know, you've made a lot of refrigerators today, and it's very high quality and very high productivity, but I'm just going to move the entire plant to Mexico, and you guys are all out of work. So what happened to your demand? You're no longer demanding increases. Now you're negotiating concessions. And if you look at what has happened, you know, largely, a lot of collective bargaining is over how many takeaways. And you don't hear so much about strikes. You hear about lockouts, right? So even the NFL umpires, you know, were locked out. The longshore workers don't strike anymore. They're locked out. So the power relationship is shifted. So the refrigerator work goes to Mexico. And then the Mexican industrialists say, you know, subsidized agriculture has wiped out a million campesinos who used to have family farms, and they are now all waiting for, you know, manufacturing jobs in maquiladoras. You really have no bargaining power, and you have no labor rights in Mexico. You're not going to be making any demand. And then a couple of years later, they say, you know what, we can actually move this to China. And as powerless as you were, that isn't to say you can't be even more powerless or have less power. Off that work goes to China. And now Vietnam has a, you know, minimum wage of 57 cents an hour. So even China, you know, it, has its increasing wages as they become more productive and more prosperous. They're at risk for Vietnam. So let's suppose you're in Malaysia and you know that there are thousands and thousands of refugees who are actually being kidnapped and held for ransom and traded from one human trafficker to another. This is as low as you can get. This is 21st century slavery. If that's part of your country's psychology, you are certainly not going to be making demand. If another major part of your economy is forced labor, people who don't have, you know, control of their employment prospects, you're certainly not going to be making demands. And if your competitive advantage as a country is that you have less power as workers than Thailand or Taiwan, again, you're not going to be making demand. So the race to the bottom is that each step along the way, you feel less secure, less empowered, less able demand a share of the gain. So the dynamic there is that's what makes it a spiral, right? It's so where would you get strength, and where would you get bargaining power? It would be from having labor rights, from having global expectations, from this is where our negotiations with TPP come in. President Obama promised, he's on the, being interviewed last night, and he said, we can raise Malaysia's labor rights, or we can raise Malaysia's environmental practices. He's really saying that there's a message, kind of a psychological target, a social target, a moral target, that we're going to raise their, improve their behavior in these various ways. The fact is that we've been engaged with Malaysia for 10 years. The State Department has had its rankings and its diplomatic engagement with Malaysia. Malaysia knows that this isn't serious. They have nothing to worry about from the U.S. State Department or from U.S. Trade Representative or any enforcement. There's no enforcement that they have to worry about from the United States. In fact, in 2012 and 2013, the president granted Malaysia a waiver. They would have been a Tier 3 country in 2012 and 13, but for the waiver that kept them at Tier 2. And in 2014, their very limited enforcement of human trafficking laws actually dropped. So instead of going up because of a legitimate concern of penalties, Malaysia knows that there's no potential threat, and they can go ahead and ignore any of this without any concern. And this has been true not just with Malaysia, but generally wherever a country with poor human rights or labor rights or environmental practices might be subject to penalties under trade agreements or any other arrangement, we've never really enforced it. So even if there's something on paper, our practice has always been to say, well, we'd much rather have your cheap goods. We'd much rather have your cheap goods than actually enforce these practices that we promised everybody we would.
But meanwhile, then, the president gets up, and so people listen to him, hear him, and then they take away the talking point. Oh, well, we'll clean this up. And they don't drill into it any further. They just assume that they can take him at his word, and this will be happening. But the people like yourself who are, regular onlookers that are, studying what actually goes on in a particular area and, working, as a labor, leading labor representative and everything, naturally this is something you would be looking at. This is what you report from the field. I remember when, I was reporting on fracking. I began reporting on fracking in about 2009 when no one really knew anything about it. And one of the prime concerns, a lot of attention was paid to, the fact that there were going to be these guidelines that the State Department of Environmental Protection was issuing, and we were looking at these guidelines and what they contained or permitted. They were lax in a variety of different ways. But what we found out, which, I never would have known, actually, was that even when they weren't lax, there were no people on staff to, enforce them. So, you can say you'll do this and you can say you do that, but if it isn't enforced, we've had problems with nuclear power plants that, like Fukushima, and, you have a catastrophe, a crisis, and they're not prepared to respond appropriately to the crisis because they never predicted the crisis. And, while they could not predict that particular tsunami, basically at the Fukushima plant, a nuclear plant, when that hit, the height of walls and the protections and all that should have been in place to deal with any kind of incursion of water, you know, which was a realistic concern, you know, had been bypassed, even though it was ostensibly. And so the government, you know, these laws are on the books, or they're very often they're not on the books, but even when they are on the books, if someone is looking the other way and it's not being enforced, then it isn't meaningful, really. And unfortunately, that happens all too often, and especially often a part of the world that most of us don't want to be thinking about very much, but, you know, or aren't thinking about very much. But this really strikes that, you know, we rely on our phones, we're taking them for granted. I mean, I was on a subway ride yesterday, and it's completely common with almost any subway ride you go on. Everybody, you know, has their nose and their smartphone. So we're, you know, kind of carrying these things around. And, you know, in the area of food, people were very ignorant, and it's taken years of education for people to realize, oh, you know, the animals were raised in such and such a manner, you know, which is perhaps undesirable. This is how this or that food I'm eating is produced. And, you know, so there's been a huge raising of awareness, and just simply taking for granted, oh, it's just here for me in the supermarket, versus, you know, how was it produced and, you know, what did that entail and what's used in the food and who was harmed as a result. You know, and for that, Michael Pollan has said, you know where your food comes from. But, you know, this is saying know where your smartphone comes from.
Right.
You know, because all of this, you know, is a factor, and really kind of clues us into, you know, the fact that we live in an interdependent world, but are we interrelating? I mean, what these treaties will in effect lay down are some of the rules and, well, very many of the rules and guidelines for that interaction. And we assume them to just be neutral and there for us, but they actually have long-reaching effects both on countries far away as well as ourselves.
Sure. So here's the way I think of that. First of all, everybody wants to believe in their leaders. Everybody wants to believe in their elected officials, that their their negotiators, the president, is looking out for them. And the president is extraordinarily articulate and eloquent and very attractive in that sense. You want to trust him and believe him. Ultimately, it comes down to whose interests are important. So when you're talking about ethically raised food, your interest as a consumer is important. And if you have a value and you're going to make purchasing decisions, suddenly the people who are producing the food have to take you seriously. They need your engagement. If you look at the way the environmental treaties are being negotiated, I know that the response to climate change, they have these huge meetings with 127 different countries and thousands of delegates. And, you know, I was at an environmental meeting and they were talking about why these meetings are so big. And they said, it's the only way it'll work. Everybody has to be engaged. Everybody has to buy in. Everybody has to see their interests being expressed. And otherwise, the climate change thing won't work. Right? Well, that's a Zen thing. You know, it's true if they say it's true. suppose I say it's false. Suppose I say I have enough power to get what I want. I don't need you along. I can give you lip service or I can ignore you, and I can still get what I want. And that's kind of the way the trade agreements have been negotiated. The corporate interest and the business interest and the investor interest are so strong. They have such strong power relationships that they don't really need labor or the environmentalists or human rights or food security interests to feel that they've been included and taken seriously. If you think you can get the deal you want that serves your interests, and you really don't care about anybody else, your tactics are to make sure your interests are served and to get the most leverage you can over other stakeholders, which means that, you know, in pure power politics, you make sure the other parties don't get anything. you want the maximum advantage over them. So the least labor rights, the least environmental rights, that gives you the most leverage down the road in making sure that you get the most gain. So if your power relationships are so strong, then and again, it's just a matter of who wakes up, you know, to see this. If you look at the way the Europeans are negotiating the European trade agreement, they have a very different political history and different political expectations. Their sense of social cohesion is much stronger. And they have the European Commission and the European Parliament and the European Constitution, and they still have the sense that public interest has to be included in the negotiations. So when they do negotiations, they tend to publish more documents, and we tend to keep them more secret. So you know, the environmental example, very open. The European practice and tradition are also relatively open. And we've just managed our approach to globalization to favor these very narrow interests. And, you know, the whole process is just structured that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm actually doing a piece about this, which hopefully will be up at the time the airing of this show. People can look for it on Alternet under my name, Alison Rose Levy, hopefully. But, you know, it leads me to, I mean, the heavy-handedness with which this is done, and the way that, in fact, in the Senate, you know, the senators who were in favor of passing fast-track and granting this authority to proceed with these treaties, the way they conducted themselves, you know, basically ridiculing anything that was a regulation, not realizing that regulations are there, you know, to serve and sustain the public in various ways. You know, the freedom they felt to publicly do this and the confidence they had that, you know, they kind of could prevail with all of this, it was disturbing to see. And one of the things that it led me to wonder is, do they need the public at all? You know, here we are, we're protesting, we're this, we're that. Are we at a point where, you know, they don't even need to consult us, and they can do this so brazenly because they've already calculated that the power balance has shifted to an extent where, you know, they can stay and do as they please at this point going forward. Do you think that's possible, or has that happened? Or, you know, I know it's a tough question in a way.
No. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's an easy question. Certainly, you know, to be president, you have to raise $1 billion. To be Mitt Romney and not be president, you needed $1 billion. And so I think everybody gets that money has distorted our political process so much that it's very hard to hear the public voice. On the other hand, you know, even as distorted as our political system is, there are at least 150 House Democrats see this trade issue as one about inequality and our ability to deal with climate change and, you know, public health issues and food security. They get it. So it's still going to be a very, very close vote in the House. You know, we've been doing a lot of lobbying on this, and I, from time to time, get to actually look at the expression on the face of members of Congress. The senators, you know, the president is very distant from people. I don't know if he ever meets, you know, regular people in a normal way. You know, Thomas Jefferson used to walk around in the market in the afternoon and look at what fruit and vegetables were available. That's certainly not the way the president, you know, manages his daily life anymore. Senators have more contact with regular people, but seriously, not all that much. When you get to the House of Representatives, these are people who do fly, you know, back to their district, in my case, every weekend or as many weekends, 40 weekends a year, and they talk to people in retirement homes and community centers and town halls. They have to actually look at people. One of the members of Congress in our area said he's never seen so many people walk through his door at his office telling him to vote against TPP on any issue, this is the most public contact he's had. And he said the only people who walk through his door telling him to vote for TPP are corporate lobbyists. So what he's saying is, I see people, I literally see people, and it makes an impression on me. This question of Malaysia and
Before we get to Malaysia, Stan, I just want to mention one thing, because it's a kind of a funny thing that you say what you do, people at the door coming in and saying, we don't want this and vote against this, because as we've been having this discussion, I had an article pulled up on my computer with a photograph accompanying the article, and I just have to describe it because it's so, you know, it's actually a video, and I'm trying to figure out how to post it as a picture on my page, because to me it so represents what we're talking about. And it was posted by the AFL-CIO, and it shows a bunch of labor of people and officials literally knocking on the wooden door of the U.S. Trade Representative, which is the public official in the office. Michael Froman is the person who has masterminded and negotiated these treaties from the American side over the last 5 years. And here are these, labor representatives and ordinary citizens literally, knocking on the wooden door, being refused entrance, and they called Homeland Security to get rid of them. and here's the photo. I'm looking at that the whole time. And actually this is the condition that we're in, that we're all in, whether we know we are or not. And so it's not only, I think the essence of it is not only that these deals for their substance and what they're allowing and including are bad, as they are, as we've detailed in today's program and in past programs, but it's also that, the process itself is shutting people out, and it's not, a sort of accident. That's happening. It's part of the intention is to, the lack of transparency, the secrecy, the do it my way or else, it's basically, it's an attempt to really, silence people's voices. But as you pointed out, people are not being silenced. They're phoning, they're writing, they're showing up at people's offices. And I just want to bring in our action point for today as well while we are discussing this, which is you can tell Congress, your congressional representatives, as well as, you can call 888-804-8311 to reach your congressional representatives. You can go to www.stopfasttrack.com. Same thing. They'll put you in touch with them by phone or by email. Phoning is better. Emailing is also good. You can do this daily, in fact. Also, if you feel so disposed, and this is just to all my listeners, you can also go to the website that I'm about to give you and do something quite interesting. It has a complete list of where every House member stands, as well as the phone numbers that I've just mentioned to you. So it says what the party is, what the vote is, the people who are voting for, against, undecided. Right now, we hold the majority and are actually winning. They won't bring it to the floor of the House unless they feel they have swayed enough people to win. Reason why it's so incredibly critical to be calling and writing and visiting and doing all of that now is because we're trying to keep the ones that we have and sway the ones who are undecided to vote no for Fast Track, to vote no and stop Fast Track. So let me tell you, if you're interested in extending beyond your own congresspeople, I know mine are both firmly opposed, you can go to the following website, Wednesday-stop-fast-call-in-day/. So that's flushthetpp.org, Wednesday, and, backslash Wednesday with all these hyphens now, Wednesday-stop-fast-track-call-in-day/. And that will provide this complete list. So if you want to be creative, you can call during the day, you can call after hours, you know, generally they're not thrilled to hear from you if you're not a constituent, but, you know, they're hearing from all of these multinational corporations.
Right.
You can also call Nancy Pelosi, who is the House Minority Leader. Her position on these questions is not yet known, although she has voted against these trade agreements in the past. She hasn't really come out to declare what she is planning to do in this instance. And so she's a very important person to call as well, because her leadership could really make a very, 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 very big difference in, you know, leading people to – she was really – and I feel she's in a poignant position because she really was looking to create consensus and, you know, if possible – do what the president wants because she's very loyal. But, you know, at the same time, I think she also has concerns about what it would do to the credibility of the Democratic Party as well as democracy to go along. So I think we can really be helpful by calling her office, which is 202-225-4965. And so now to return for our last 8 minutes or so of the program, sorry to have interrupted you for this activism announcement, but you were going to tell us something further about how Malaysia ties in with all of this.
I want to say one more thing about calling your representative. If your representative is, you know, has a good position on this, they need to be thanked. And they're going to get, they're still, everybody is under real intense pressure from the White House and from lobbyists. You always think of calling your elected official if they're not, you know, thinking like you are, but you also call the ones that are and think they need to hear that. Getting back
good
to
point.
This perception that elected officials have, even if they have been persuaded, you know, by the corporate point of view, when they have to face you and explain what they've done, I had this experience with one of our elected officials. This is a guy who had been the sheriff of King County and had dealt personally with human trafficking in our own community. Somebody who you'd think would have empathy for this issue, and he said he did. And he's having to explain to me why he's going to let Malaysia into the TPP as a Tier 3 violator of human trafficking. That's got to make an impression on him, right? So talking about something as clear-cut and as profoundly moral as, human trafficking, if you ever get a chance to do that, the more, you know, personal the connection is to that, the better. This is really an opportunity for us in moving both. I don't want to say it that way. I'm not taking advantage of this awful situation, but this is one that I think can be very, very persuasive. And it speaks to the entire issue that we've been talking about, you know. How are the gains going to be divided? If we're talking about prosperity, that would be great. If we're down to the point of human trafficking, that's where the threshold is. You know, that's a completely different story.
Let me just reiterate one thing. That's what a race to the bottom is. In other words, instead of striving upward toward prosperity, we're going to be, you know, the net result is, and this is really seriously true, going to be downhill. You know, if you've had any economic struggle recently, in the last 5-10 years, if you know anyone who has, or maybe, you know, you live in a rarefied group that has been exempt from that, you know, people who have trouble finding housing, who have health issues, you know, all the things that happen here in the human race, you know, if there have been any problems, you know, they're not going to get easier. So, in fact, they could, you know, go notably worse. That's what a race to the bottom entails in the lives of people. And, you know, unless any of us are in the 1%, and maybe even then, we're not excluded, you know, from those concerns. So that's also, this is in your self-interest, I just have to say, for most of us. Sorry to interrupt you so rudely once again. What were you going to say?
No, that's a good point. Again, going back to what I was saying about negotiating and bargaining, if you're expecting to demand a gain, right, the employer's unlikely to just hand you a share. You have to have some kind of bargaining power. In order to have bargaining power, you have to have some kind of psychological strength. You have to have a position of confidence. And if you're surrounded by a community that is full of all these terrible experiences, that affects you. Here's a very simple example. We represent engineers and scientists, and we have a process at work for getting a raise and getting an upgrade. Some of our workers are H-1B workers on temporary visa. We saw one who was misclassified, and we said, look, we can get you an upgrade. He said, don't rock the boat. I don't want to risk my status. We said, listen, this is an internal process. Your supervisor is your champion. We do this all the time. No, I don't want to. He didn't feel strength to pursue his own interests. Right? Mm-hmm. This is a guy who has a union, who has a sympathetic supervisor, who has an internal process. It should be another day at work for him getting his share of prosperity. He feels precarious and won't act in his own interest. This is at the top of the the labor market.
Right.
Even there.
I just want to say, too, it's like, you know, a lot of Americans don't act in their own interests because they're too, desperate to maintain the lifestyle they currently have. And, they're too concerned about their families. So, if you listeners or others that you know are not taking action, actually, that's a symptom of of being under some duress and not really acting in your own interest, actually. I mean, strange as it seems. So the cure for that is actually to get involved, because I think what this has shown us is how narrow the window actually is. So we're doing it not for the sake of trade deals or treaties, which may seem kind of abstract, even though we've done our best over the last 3-4 months to portray the full range of their effects, which will impact all of us. But also because this is the narrow window in which we still get to choose democracy and act. And we see how tight that is, thanks to, and how narrower it is. And we may feel indeed worried and disempowered even by that. And in fact, that's a very understandable reaction. This is kind of scary. But, I'm worried, very concerned about it too, obviously, or I wouldn't be doing this. But, the way through is to step up into taking action and use the power we now have, because it could be lesser if we fail to use it over time. And this, what we're describing as the current state of affairs, is a symptom of a devolution. And so, that's why strongly urging you to go to www, stop fast track, and do the other things that we've, that we have suggested here. It's coming around to the time where we need to wrap up the show. And, so let's just do, final words from you, Stan, and then I'll kind of do our wrap up.
Mm-hmm. I was doing phone banking the other night, and I was talking to a cab driver trying to get him to call his congressman, and he was discouraged and he was disillusioned. And I said, listen, this is your one chance. This is your voice. This is the moment. You have to call your congressman. And he said, hang on. And he said, I'm pulling over. I'm going to stop the car. Tell me the phone number. And this was an immigrant, somebody not, familiar with our, democratic traditions, but he wanted it to work. And he called his congressman.
That's beautiful. I love that as a way to go out here, Stan. And listeners, Not only, let's take that as like a kind of an inspiring thing that we can all emulate, you know, because you can not only take action yourself, but you can let five other people know, you know, tell other people, let other people know. It's amazing how few people who would be concerned are even aware that this is happening. Give them that gift, let them know, tell them what they can do if they feel it and share your concern. And thank you for doing that. And thank you, Stan, for your commitment, your persistence, for being with us today, and for another terrific conversation. So grateful for everything.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well and take action, and let's make this the week we win by getting a no vote on and stopping Fast Track.
Well, well, well.